Are there any other symmetry principles having to do with space, time, and motion that the laws of nature should respect? If you think about this, you might come up with one more possibility. The laws of physics should not care about the angle from which you make your observations. For instance, if you perform some experiment and then decide to rotate all of your equipment and do the experiment again, the same laws should apply. This is known as rotational symmetry, and it means that the laws of physics treat all possible orientations on equal footing. It is a symmetry principle that is on par with the previous ones discussed. Are there others? Have we overlooked any symmetries? You might suggest the gauge symmetries associated with the non-gravitational forces as discussed in Chapter 5. These are certainly symmetries of nature, but they are of a more abstract sort. Our focus here is on symmetries that have a direct link to space, time, or motion. With this stipulation, it's now likely that you can't think of any other possibilities. In fact, in 1967, physicists Sidney Coleman and Geoffrey Mandula were able to prove that no other symmetries associated with space, time, or motion could be combined with those just discussed and result in a theory bearing any resemblance to our world. Subsequently, though, close examination of this theorem, based on insights of a number of physicists, revealed precisely one subtle loophole. The Coleman-Mandula result did not exploit fully symmetries sensitive to something known as spin. Spin. An elementary particle, such as an electron, can orbit an atomic nucleus in somewhat the same way that the Earth orbits the Sun. But in the traditional point particle description of an electron, it would appear that there is no analog of the Earth's spinning around on its axis. When any object spins, points on the axis of rotation itself, like the central point of a spinning frisbee, do not move. If something is truly point-like, though, it has no other points that lie off of any purported spin axis. And so it would appear that there simply is no notion of a point object spinning. Many years ago, such reasoning fell prey to yet another quantum mechanical surprise. In 1925, the Dutch physicists George Uhlenbeck and Samuel Goudschmidt realized that a wealth of puzzling data having to do with the properties of light emitted and absorbed by atoms could be explained if electrons were assumed to have very particular magnetic properties. Some 100 years earlier, the Frenchman André-Marie Ampère had shown that magnetism arises from the motion of electric charge. Uhlenbeck and Goudschmidt followed this lead and found that only one specific sort of electron motion could give rise to the magnetic properties suggested by the data, rotational motion, that is, spin. Contrary to classical expectations, Uhlenbeck and Goudschmidt proclaimed that, somewhat like the Earth, electrons both revolve and rotate. Did Uhlenbeck and Goudschmidt literally mean that the electron is spinning? Yes and no. What their work really showed is that there is a quantum mechanical notion of spin that is somewhat akin to the usual image, but inherently quantum mechanical in nature. It's one of those properties of the microscopic world that brushes up against classical ideas but injects an experimentally verified quantum twist. For instance, picture a spinning skater. As she pulls her arms in, she spins more quickly. As she stretches out her arms, she spins more slowly. And sooner or later, depending on how vigorously she threw herself into the spin, she will slow down and stop. Not so for the kind of spin revealed by Uhlenbeck and Goudschmidt. According to their work and subsequent studies, every electron in the universe, always and forever, spins at one fixed and never-changing rate. The spin of an electron is not a transitory state of motion, as for more familiar objects that, for some reason or other, happen to be spinning. Instead, the spin of an electron is an intrinsic property, much like its mass or its electric charge. If an electron were not spinning, it would not be an electron. Although early work focused on the electron, Physicists have subsequently shown that these ideas about spin apply equally well to all of the matter particles that fill out the three families of fundamental particles. This is true down to the last detail. All of the matter particles, and their antimatter partners as well, have spin equal to that of the electron. In the language of the trade, physicists say that matter particles all have spin 1/2, where the value 1/2 is, roughly speaking, a quantum mechanical measure of how quickly the particles rotate. Moreover, physicists have shown that the non-gravitational force carriers, photons, weak gauge bosons, and gluons, also possess an intrinsic spinning characteristic that turns out to be twice that of the matter particles. They all have spin 1. What about gravity? Well, even before string theory, physicists were able to determine what spin the hypothesized graviton must have to be the transmitter of the gravitational force. The answer? Twice the spin of photons, weak gauge bosons, and gluons, i.e., spin 2. In the context of string theory, spin, just like mass and force charges, is associated with the pattern of vibration that a string executes. As with point particles, it's a bit misleading to think of the spin carried by a string as arising from its spinning literally around in space. But this image does give a loose picture to have in mind. By the way, we can now clarify an important issue we encountered earlier. In 1974, when Shirk and Schwartz proclaimed that string theory should be thought of as a quantum theory incorporating the gravitational force, they did so because they had found that strings necessarily have a vibrational pattern in their repertoire that is massless and has spin too, the hallmark features of the graviton. Where there is a graviton, there is also gravity. With this background on the concept of spin, let's now turn to the role it plays in revealing the loophole in the Coleman-Mandula result concerning the possible symmetries of nature mentioned in the preceding section. Supersymmetry and superpartners. As we have emphasized, the concept of spin, although superficially akin to the image of a spinning top, differs in substantial ways that are rooted in quantum mechanics. Its discovery in 1925 revealed that there is another kind of rotational motion that simply would not exist in a purely classical universe. This suggests the following question. Just as ordinary rotational motion allows for the symmetry principle of rotational invariance, physics treats all spatial orientations on an equal footing, could it be that the more subtle rotational motion associated with spin leads to another possible symmetry of the laws of nature? By 1971 or so, physicists showed that the answer to this question was yes. Although the full story is quite involved, the basic idea is that when spin is considered, there is precisely one more symmetry of the laws of nature that is mathematically possible. It is known as supersymmetry. Supersymmetry cannot be associated with a simple and intuitive change in observational vantage point, shifts in time, in spatial location, in angular orientation, and in velocity of motion exhaust these possibilities. But just as spin is like rotational motion with a quantum mechanical twist, supersymmetry can be associated with a change in observational vantage point in a quantum mechanical extension of space and time. These quotes are especially important, as the last sentence is only meant to give a rough sense of where supersymmetry fits into the larger framework of symmetry principles. Nevertheless, although understanding the origin of supersymmetry is rather subtle, we will focus on one of its primary implications. Should the laws of nature incorporate its principles? And this is far easier to grasp. In the early 1970s, physicists realized that if the universe is supersymmetric, the particles of nature must come in pairs whose respective spins differ by half a unit. Such pairs of particles, regardless of whether they are thought of as point-like, as in the Standard Model, or as tiny vibrating loops, are called superpartners. Since matter particles have spin 1/2, while some of the messenger particles have spin 1, supersymmetry appears to result in a pairing, a partnering of matter and force particles. As such, it seems like a wonderful unifying concept. The problem comes in the details. By the mid-1970s, when physicists sought to incorporate supersymmetry into the standard model, they found that none of the known particles, the fundamental particles and the force particles, could be superpartners of one another. Instead, detailed theoretical analysis showed that if the universe incorporates supersymmetry, then every known particle must have an as-yet-undiscovered superpartner particle, whose spin is half a unit less than its known counterpart. For instance, there should be a spin zero partner of the electron. This hypothetical particle has been named the selectron, a contraction of supersymmetric electron. The same should also be true for the other matter particles with, for example, the hypothetical spin zero superpartners of neutrinos and quarks being called sneutrinos and squarks. Similarly, the force particles should have spin 1/2 superpartners. For photons, there should be photinos. For the gluons, there should be gluinos. For the W and Z bosons, there should be winos and zenos. On closer inspection, then, supersymmetry seems to be a terribly uneconomical feature. It requires a whole slew of additional particles that wind up doubling the list of fundamental ingredients. Since none of the superpartner particles has ever been detected, you would be justified to take Robbie's remark from Chapter 1 regarding the discovery of the muon one step further, declare that nobody ordered supersymmetry, and summarily reject this symmetry principle. For three reasons, however, many physicists believe strongly that such an out-of-hand dismissal of supersymmetry would be quite premature. Let's discuss these reasons. The case for supersymmetry prior to string theory. First, from an aesthetic standpoint, physicists find it hard to believe that nature would respect almost but not quite all of the symmetries that are mathematically possible. Of course, it is possible that an incomplete utilization of symmetry is what actually occurs, but it would be such a shame. It would be as if Bach, after developing numerous intertwining voices to fill out an ingenious pattern of musical symmetry, left out the final resolving measure. Second, even within the standard model, a theory that ignores gravity, thorny technical issues that are associated with quantum processes are swiftly solved if the theory is supersymmetric. The basic problem is that every distinct particle species makes its own contribution to the microscopic quantum mechanical frenzy. Physicists have found that in the bath of this frenzy, certain processes involving particle interactions remain consistent only if numerical parameters in the standard model are fine-tuned to better than one part in a million billion to cancel out the most pernicious quantum effects. Such precision is on par with adjusting the launch angle of a bullet fired from an enormously powerful rifle, so that it hits a specified target on the moon with a margin of error no greater than the thickness of an amoeba. Although numerical adjustments of an analogous precision can be made within the standard model, many physicists are quite suspect of a theory that is so delicately constructed that it falls apart if a number on which it depends is changed in the 15th digit after the decimal point. Supersymmetry changes this drastically because bosons, particles whose spin is a whole number, named after the Indian physicist Satyendra Bose, and fermions, particles whose spin is half of a whole odd number, named after the Italian physicist Enrico Fermi, tend to give canceling quantum mechanical contributions. Like opposite ends of a seesaw, when the quantum jitters of a boson are positive, those of a fermion tend to be negative, and vice versa. Since supersymmetry ensures that bosons and fermions occur in pairs, substantial cancellations occur from the outset, cancellations that significantly calm some of the frenzied quantum effects. It turns out that the consistency of the supersymmetric standard model, the standard model augmented by all of the superpartner particles, no longer relies upon the uncomfortably delicate numerical adjustments of the ordinary standard model. Although this is a highly technical issue, many particle physicists find that this realization makes supersymmetry very attractive. The third piece of circumstantial evidence for supersymmetry comes from the notion of grand unification. One of the puzzling features of nature's four forces is the huge range of their intrinsic strengths. The electromagnetic force has less than 1% of the strength of the strong force. The weak force is some 1,000 times feebler than that. And the gravitational force is some 100 million billion billion billion, 10^-35th power, times weaker still. Following the path-breaking and ultimately Nobel Prize-winning work of Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg that established a deep connection between the electromagnetic and weak forces, discussed in Chapter 5, in 1974 Glashow, together with his Harvard colleague Howard Georgie, suggested that an analogous connection might be forged with the strong force. Their work, which proposed a grand unification of three of the four forces, differed in one essential way from that of the electroweak theory. Whereas the electromagnetic and weak forces crystallized out of a more symmetric union when the temperature of the universe dropped to about 1,000,000,000,000 degrees above absolute zero, 10^15 Kelvin, Georgie and Glashow showed that the union with the strong force would have been apparent only at a temperature some 10 trillion times higher, around 10 billion 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 degrees above absolute zero, 10^28 Kelvin. From the point of view of energy, this is about 1,000,000,000,000 times the mass of the proton, or about 4 orders of magnitude less than the Planck mass. Georgie and Glashow boldly took theoretical physics into an energy realm many orders of magnitude beyond that which anyone had previously dared explore. Subsequent work at Harvard by Georgie, Helen Quinn, and Weinberg in 1974 made the potential unity of the non-gravitational forces within the grand unified framework even more manifest. As their contribution continues to play an important role in unifying the forces and in assessing the relevance of supersymmetry to the natural world, let's spend a moment explaining it. We are all aware that the electrical attraction between two oppositely charged particles, or the gravitational attraction between two massive bodies, gets stronger as the distance between the objects decreases. These are simple and well-known features of classical physics. There is a surprise, though, when we study the effect that quantum physics has on force strengths. Why should quantum mechanics have any effect at all? The answer, once again, lies in quantum fluctuations. When we examine the electric force field of an electron, for example, we are actually examining it through the mist of momentary particle-antiparticle eruptions and annihilations that are occurring all through the region of space surrounding it. Physicists some time ago realized that this seething mist of microscopic fluctuations obscures the full strength of the electron's force field, somewhat as a thin fog partially obscures the beacon of a lighthouse. But notice that as we get closer to the electron, we will have penetrated more of the cloaking particle-antiparticle mist, and hence will be less subject to its diminishing influence. This implies that the strength of an electron's electric field will increase as we get closer to it. Physicists distinguish this quantum mechanical increase in strength as we get closer to the electron from that known in classical physics by saying that the intrinsic strength of the electromagnetic force increases on shorter distance scales. This reflects that the strength increases not merely because we are closer to the electron, but also because more of the electron's intrinsic electric field becomes visible. In fact, although we have focused on the electron, this discussion applies equally well to all electrically charged particles and is summarized by saying that quantum effects drive the strength of the electromagnetic force to get larger when examined on shorter distance scales. What about the other forces of the Standard Model? How do their intrinsic strengths vary with distance? In 1973, Gross and Frank Wilczek at Princeton and, independently, David Politzer at Harvard studied this question and found a surprising answer. The quantum cloud of particle eruptions and annihilations amplifies the strengths of the strong and weak forces. This implies that as we examine them on shorter distances, we penetrate more of this seething cloud and hence are subject to less of its amplification. And so, the strengths of these forces get weaker when they are probed on shorter distances. Georgie, Quinn, and Weinberg took this realization and ran with it to a remarkable end. They showed that when these effects of the quantum frenzy are carefully accounted for, the net result is that the strengths of all three non-gravitational forces are driven together. Whereas the strengths of these forces are very different on scales accessible to current technology, Georgie, Quinn, and Weinberg argued that this difference is actually due to the different effect that the haze of microscopic quantum activity has on each force. Their calculations showed that if this haze is penetrated by examining the forces not on everyday scales, but as they act on distances of about a hundredth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth, 10 to the minus 29th power, of a centimeter, a mere factor of 10,000 larger than the Planck length, the three non-gravitational force strengths appear to become equal. Although far removed from the realm of common experience, the high energy necessary to be sensitive to such small distances was characteristic of the roiling, hot early universe when it was about a thousandth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth, 10 to the minus 39th power, of a second old, when its temperature was on the order of 10 to the 28th power Kelvin mentioned earlier. In somewhat the same way that a collection of disparate ingredients, pieces of metal, wood, rocks, minerals, and so on, all melt together and become a uniform homogeneous plasma when heated to sufficiently high temperature, these theoretical works suggested that the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces all merge into one grand force at such immense temperatures. Although we do not have the technology to probe such minute distance scales or to produce such scorching temperatures, since 1974, experimentalists have significantly refined the measured strengths of the three non-gravitational forces under everyday conditions. These data are the input data for the quantum mechanical extrapolations of Georgie, Quinn, and Weinberg. In 1991, Ugo Amaldi of CERN, Wim de Boer, and Hermann Furstenau of the University of Karlsruhe, Germany, recalculated the Georgie, Quinn, and Weinberg extrapolations, making use of these experimental refinements, and showed two significant things. First, the strengths of the three non-gravitational forces almost agree, but not quite, at tiny distance scales, equivalently high energy, high temperature. Second, this tiny but undeniable discrepancy in their strengths vanishes if supersymmetry is incorporated. The reason is that the new superpartner particles required by supersymmetry contribute additional quantum fluctuations, and these fluctuations are just right to nudge the strengths of the forces to converge with one another. To many physicists, it is extremely difficult to believe that nature would choose the forces so that they almost, but not quite, have strengths that microscopically unify, microscopically become equal. It's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle in which the final piece is slightly misshapen and won't cleanly fit into its appointed position. Supersymmetry deftly refines its shape so that all pieces firmly lock into place. Another aspect of this latter realization is that it provides a possible answer to the question, why haven't we discovered any of the superpartner particles? The calculations that lead to the convergence of the force strengths, as well as other considerations studied by a number of physicists, indicate that the superpartner particles must be a good deal heavier than the known particles. Although no definitive predictions can be made, studies show that the superpartner particles might be 1,000 times as massive as a proton, if not heavier. As even our state-of-the-art accelerators cannot quite reach such energies, this provides an explanation for why these particles have not, as yet, been discovered. In Chapter 9, we will return to a discussion of the experimental prospects for determining in the near future whether supersymmetry truly is a property of our world. Of course, the reasons we have given for believing in, or at least not yet rejecting, supersymmetry are far from airtight. We have described how supersymmetry elevates our theories to their most symmetric form, but you might suggest that the universe does not care about attaining the most symmetric form that is mathematically possible. We have noted the important technical point that supersymmetry relieves us from the delicate task of tuning numerical parameters in the standard model to avoid subtle quantum problems. But you might argue that the true theory describing nature may very well walk the fine edge between self-consistency and self-destruction. We have discussed how supersymmetry modifies the intrinsic strengths of the three non-gravitational forces at tiny distances in just the right way for them to merge together into a grand unified force. But you might argue, again, that nothing in the design of nature dictates that these force strengths must exactly match on microscopic scales. And finally, you might suggest that a simpler explanation for why the superpartner particles have never been found is that our universe is not supersymmetric, and therefore, the superpartners do not exist. No one can refute any of these responses, but the case for supersymmetry is strengthened immensely when we consider its role in string theory. Supersymmetry in string theory. The original string theory that emerged from Veneziano's work in the late 1960s incorporated all of the symmetries discussed at the beginning of this chapter, but it did not incorporate supersymmetry, which had not yet been discovered. This first theory, based on the string concept, was, more precisely, called the bosonic string theory. The name bosonic indicates that all of the vibrational patterns of the bosonic string have spins that are a whole number. There are no fermionic patterns, that is, no patterns with spins differing from a whole number by a half unit. This led to two problems. First, if string theory was to describe all forces and all matter, it would somehow have to incorporate fermionic vibrational patterns, since the known matter particles all have spin one-half. Second, and far more troubling, was the realization that there was one pattern of vibration in bosonic string theory whose mass, more precisely whose mass squared, was negative, a so-called tachyon. Even before string theory, physicists had studied the possibility that our world might have tachyon particles, in addition to the familiar particles that all have positive masses, but their efforts showed that it is difficult, if not impossible, for such a theory to be logically sensible. Similarly, in the context of bosonic string theory, physicists tried all sorts of fancy footwork to make sense of the bizarre prediction of a tachyon vibrational pattern, but to no avail. These features made it increasingly clear that although it was an interesting theory, the bosonic string was missing something essential. In 1971, Pierre Raymond of the University of Florida took up the challenge of modifying the bosonic string theory to include fermionic patterns of vibration. Through his work and subsequent results of Schwartz and André Neveu, a new version of string theory began to emerge. And much to everyone's surprise, the bosonic and the fermionic patterns of vibration of this new theory appeared to come in pairs. For each bosonic pattern, there was a fermionic pattern, and vice versa. By 1977, insights of Ferdinando Gliozzi of the University of Turin, Shirk, and David Olive of Imperial College put this pairing into the proper light. The new string theory incorporated supersymmetry, and the observed pairing of bosonic and fermionic vibrational patterns reflected this highly symmetric character. Supersymmetric string theory, superstring theory, that is, had been born. Moreover, the work of Gliozzi, Shirk, and Olive had one other crucial result. They showed that the troublesome tachyon vibration of the bosonic string does not afflict the superstring. Slowly, the pieces of the string puzzle were falling into place. Nevertheless, the major initial impact of the work of Ramond, and also of Neveu and Schwartz, was not actually in string theory. By 1973, the physicists Julius Vess and Bruno Zumino realized that supersymmetry, the new symmetry emerging from the reformulation of string theory, was applicable even to theories based on point particles. They rapidly made important strides toward incorporating supersymmetry into the framework of point particle quantum field theory. And since, at the time, quantum field theory was the central rage of the mainstream particle physics community, with string theory increasingly becoming a subject on the fringe, the insights of Vess and Zumino launched a tremendous amount of subsequent research on what has come to be called supersymmetric quantum field theory. The supersymmetric standard model, discussed in the preceding section, is one of the crowning theoretical achievements of these pursuits. We now see that, through historical twists and turns, even this point particle theory owes a great debt to string theory. With the resurgence of superstring theory in the mid-1980s, supersymmetry has reemerged in the context of its original discovery, and in this framework, the case for supersymmetry goes well beyond that presented in the preceding section. String theory is the only way we know of to merge general relativity and quantum mechanics. But it's only the supersymmetric version of string theory that avoids the pernicious tachyon problem and that has fermionic vibrational patterns that can account for the matter particles constituting the world around us. Supersymmetry, therefore, comes hand in hand with string theory's proposal for a quantum theory of gravity, as well as with its grand claim of uniting all forces and all of matter. If string theory is right, physicists expect that so is supersymmetry. Until the mid-1990s, however, one particularly troublesome aspect plagued supersymmetric string theory. A super embarrassment of riches. If someone tells you that they have solved the mystery of Amelia Earhart's fate, you might be skeptical at first. But if they have a well-documented, thoroughly pondered explanation, you would probably hear them out, and who knows, you might even be convinced. But what if, in the next breath, they tell you that they actually have a second explanation as well? You listen patiently and are surprised to find the alternate explanation to be as well-documented and thought through as the first. And after finishing the second explanation, you are presented with a third, a fourth, and even a fifth explanation, each different from the others and yet equally convincing. No doubt, by the end of the experience, you would feel no closer to Amelia Earhart's true fate than you did at the outset. In the arena of fundamental explanations, more is definitely less. By 1985, string theory, notwithstanding the justified excitement it was engendering, was starting to sound like our overzealous Earhart expert. The reason is that by 1985, physicists realized that supersymmetry, by then a central element in the structure of string theory, could actually be incorporated into string theory in not one, but five different ways. Each method results in a pairing of bosonic and fermionic vibrational patterns, but the details of this pairing, as well as numerous other properties of the resulting theories, differ substantially. Although their names are not all that important, it's worth recording that these five supersymmetric string theories are called the Type 1 theory, the Type 2A theory, the Type 2B theory, the heterodic Type O32 theory, and the heterodic Type E8 times E8 theory. All the features of string theory that we have discussed to this point are valid for each of these theories. They differ only in the finer details. Having five different versions of what is supposedly the TOE, possibly the ultimate unified theory, was quite an embarrassment for string theorists. Just as there is only one true explanation for whatever happened to Amelia Earhart, regardless of whether we will ever find it, we expect the same to be true regarding the deepest, most fundamental understanding of how the world works. We live in one universe, we expect one explanation.